This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Drug overdose deaths, especially from opioids, continue to be a national epidemic. Coming up, we'll look back to previous decades when punishment, not treatment, was emphasized for drug users, especially people of color. We'll ask what lessons have been learned to help everyone struggling with addiction. Echo Yanka, professor of law at Yeshiva University in New York City, will join us later in the show. Now, here in Connecticut, the overdose death rate has been higher than the national average for several years now. Coming up, we hear about efforts by the Connecticut Opioid Response Team, or CORE. It was formed by the governor last summer to reduce opioid-related overdose deaths. And we'll talk to the first selectman of Oxford, Connecticut, to find out how his small town is addressing this growing problem. Now, how has addiction impacted your life? What strategies do you think local communities and governments should take to help families? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, over the last year, Where We Live's devoted several shows to addiction. And in each story we've heard, there have been similarities and differences. Addiction doesn't always end in the loss of life. There are plenty of recovery stories, too. One of those stories belongs to Ben Grippo. He's a West Hartford resident, also a counselor at Hartford Dispensary in Bristol. Ben's in studio with me. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Bristol, right where I work. And I went to Bristol Central High School. I graduated in 1997. And years later, I moved to the Hartford area, and I've lived here ever since. For by about 16, 17 years now.
You're also in recovery. Tell us when you first started using.
So, this was probably right out of high school. I didn't really have any direction after high school, so I joined the Army. And I went to basic training, and I returned. And just began my downward spiral. I was, discharged from the Army for, my behavior outside in my civilian life, and that kind of threw me down mentally and emotionally, and I started using drugs. I moved to Poughkeepsie, New York in about 98, and I was in a band, and I moved up there because I was a bass player in a band, and I was sick of driving there twice a week to practice, and the lead singer of my band at the time had been using heroin for a few years. And just like a young, dumb kid, he asked me one day if I wanted to try it. And I was just like, you're 18 years old. You're kind of invincible. And I was like, yeah, why not? And that lit the fuse. And for the next 8 years, that pretty much consumed my life. And been to prison for it, on and off, intravenous user, also intravenously using cocaine. It wasn't any stretch of the imagination that I would be doing PCP or smoking crack or anything like that. Throughout the whole week, this took a place for 8 years. And one day, a friend of mine's mother was like, she was very cool about it too. She's like, you ever thought about getting help? And she wasn't like pushing it on me. She's like, did you ever think about getting help? And she works at a treatment facility still to this day. And her name is Carol Grimm. And that kind of planted the seed in my head. And one day I came home and I did not have anything left to sell in my apartment. I didn't even have a doorknob. I had a sock that was tied in a knot. And I was like, okay, it's time to do something about it. This is my rock bottom. And I attempted to go to a local hospital a couple times. I was on methadone at the time. I was a patient for the clinic that I work for today. And they wouldn't take me. They told me I was on too much methadone. And about a couple weeks battle with them, being kicked back out, spending a night in detox, being kicked back out. I admitted to my mother that was going on. And at this time, she thought I was still okay. I wasn't using. And I admitted to her that I had been using. And she showed up at my house the next day with probably a ream of paper. And she had printed out information to every treatment facility, to the tip of Florida, to the tip of Maine. And she goes, we're going to call every single one of these until you get a bed somewhere. And I was like, okay. And the first one we called was the old Cedar Crest on Vine Street, part of Mount Sinai Hospital. And they were like, can you be here tomorrow at 1? It was a Saturday. So they wanted me to come in on a Sunday. I entered treatment. I stayed there for 4 weeks. And at the end of the 4 weeks, my counselor said, so do you want to go home and get involved in the same stuff you were doing before? Or do you want to go to long-term treatment? And I had lost my job at this time, and I thought it would be a good idea. So I went to a place called the Liberation House in Stamford, Connecticut. It's not a men's program anymore. It's one of the women's programs where you can bring your children while you're receiving treatment. But when I went there, I stayed there for 8.5 months. And it's a little bit of between methadone and the time of stay I was in rehab that I attest my recovery to. Mm-hmm. And when I got in, they started tapering me off of methadone. I stayed there for 8.5 months, transitioned to a sober house, transitioned off of methadone, stayed at a sober house for about 6 months down in Stamford, got homesick, wanted to come back to Hartford, came back to Hartford, moved in with a friend, and started like a real life of not using.
A few things strike me about your story. One, that you were an active drug user for 8 years and you didn't die.
I'm very lucky, very lucky. And the game has changed. It's not like it was when I was using.
Explain what that means, because I've heard that before, and for our listeners, the potency of the drugs out there that people are using?
There's a huge problem and epidemic with fentanyl right now being cut into all types of heroin. And I don't want to assume, but I would assume that if anybody bought a bag of heroin off the street in Hartford today, it'd be about 50-50 and maybe even 90% fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And these dealers and people that are cutting the fentanyl, it's way cheaper than heroin, and it gives you the same effect, but if you're not a chemist, so you don't know how much, and that's why all these people are ODing, because you can go do, like in the height of my using, I would shoot 12 bags of heroin at a time. If you did that today with a dealer that you didn't know, you're going to die. You're going to overdose. And it's super cheap. You can buy it on the dark web. You know, like you can get it anywhere. You can get it shipped to your house on like some weird websites. They make it in Mexico. They make it in the States. They make it in the Middle East. It's like, it's a huge problem, and it's really weird to say. But like, if you know that you're getting 100% heroin, you're kind of like blessed right now because it's such a problem, you know. And but nobody really is anymore.
The other thing about your story is your mother came to you and said, if you need help, we're going to get you help. And mm-hmm. we hear that story often from families that will take out second mortgages if they have to so that their loved one can get into treatment.
Totally.
But there are a lack of beds. What would have happened to you if you weren't able to get into long-term treatment?
If I had to speculate, I would probably go home, not use for a couple days, and then fall right back into it because the addiction is so strong. It's such a hold on you. It's like nothing I've ever felt before. And after living all these years afterwards, it's just like I've never had anything grip me like that. Like I like sweets. Like I couldn't be like that's really all I can attest it to because it's like the power of not being able to say no. Like I could be like, okay, I'm gonna start this ketogenic diet this week. No carbs, no sugar. Somebody places a piece of cheesecake in front of me and I'm like a dog. Like I'll eat it without thinking the consequences and going back on that time that I had. It's the strongest grip that I've ever experienced in my life and it was so hard to break.
Has it been difficult to not relapse?
I think about my personal situation and I've never been tempted to use any sort of opioid. I've never been tempted to use anything, any illegal substance. I don't drink. I don't smoke cigarettes. But I think about it every once in a while because I sit with people all day in my job, and this is the what they're facing every day. And I've never really been tempted to use it or like relapse. It's just like everything kind of got progressively better. I could see if somebody like tried to get clean and then they had a bunch of life events that kind of like, you know, somebody dying or something, you getting super depressed or something and then turning back to it. But no, I never was. And once I got the job that I had, you know, it made it so much more real. And it's really been a non-existent thought in my mind because I have to be what I am today for the population I serve.
This is Where We Live. In studio with me, Ben Grippo, a West Hartford resident, a counselor at Hartford Dispensary in Bristol. He's sharing his story of recovery with us as we focus on addiction on the show this hour. Ben, you mentioned it sounds like you take a lot of comfort and get a lot out of your job helping people at this methadone clinic. Tell me about the people that you I know you can't do specifics, but the people that you help at the methadone clinic, what are their stories? How do they end up where they are today?
I love my patients. You know, like they're all different, black, white, short, tall, big and skinny, old and young. It really has no, like, addiction has no face. And there's just something about somebody in recovery or somebody that's been addicted at some point that they just have this air about them. And it's kind of like a casual humor. Like a lot of my patients, like, they're dealing with a life-threatening, you know, disorder, opioid use disorder, and they'll come into my office and they'll crack jokes and make me laugh. You know what I mean? And it's just like, it's so inspiring to see somebody that's dealing with something that's so life-threatening, but finding the good in their day and moving on. You know what I mean? And I don't remember me being like that. I remember me in my time of using just being so, like, sullen and like, life is over. You know what I mean? And I didn't change my tune until I met my counselor, you know what I mean? And he gave me some hope, you know, and I attest my recovery to myself. Like, I did it myself, but I'll tell you what, if I didn't meet that man when I went to long-term treatment, things would have went way, way different. These people are dealing with all kinds of stuff that I never dealt with. You know, my bottom was my bottom, but these people are, like, losing their kids to a overdose, losing their parents to overdose, like, going through crazy custody battles, like, because they've gotten in trouble, like DCF, they're in court. And it's just like, knowing that they're dealing with all that stuff and they're coming and spending a short time with me and they leave the clinic feeling a little bit better about the session we had, that's why I do it.
Explain how methadone is helping them in their brain. And then if you could address the stigma that surrounds people who end up needing methadone to help them.
Oh, I've written so many papers on the stigmatization of methadone patients. So methadone is an opioid, and there's receptors in your brain that are filled with the opiate that you choose to use, and that's what gives you the euphoric high. Methadone is quite the same, where it goes into these receptors in your brain, but methadone is designed to taper somebody off of the program. That's why they call it methadone maintenance, okay? It's a harm reduction model. You can go in, you can get on methadone, and you could taper down, and you can get off and live a drug-free life. You can also go on a methadone, stay there for the rest of your life, and I attest it to taking insulin away from a diabetic. If it's working for the person, and it's their providing for their children, they're going to work, they're living a drug-free life, and they're happy, who are we to take it away from them? Some people like to stay on for long periods of time. Some people go in and get it done. It's just, you know, as far as the brain chemistry goes, like, I'm not really a chemist, but, you know, you have a setting where you are receiving counseling. And it's a safe area to come and, you know, deal with your addiction. I know so many people that are like, I'm going to kick it cold turkey, or I'm going to do it myself, like, while using heroin. And it's like, it'll never happen. You need to be in a setting where you have like-minded people going through the same thing, where you have a counselor helping you through your issues. We have, like, medical services, people get physicals once a year. We have psych services. You know, you can see a psychiatrist and be prescribed any type of med if you have, like, an anxiety disorder or depression. So it's all encompassing. I don't know if I answered your question. No, sorry.
Well, I wanted to talk with you because you are working at a clinic and methadone helped you, but to also hear, you know, people's reactions when there's so much judgment
there
when
is.
You are an addict.
Definitely.
And it starts with, why does someone start to begin with? And then it's, well, if you're really clean, does it mean you need to be on something? But everyone, like you said, is different.
Everybody has their own way of thinking about it. Me personally, I started counting my clean time the first day I didn't have methadone. And it's very stigmatized. You know, I know a lot of people that used to go to, like, NA meetings, and they would keep the topic that they were on methadone off the table, because the minute you disclose that in that setting, you are stigmatized. Mm. And I tell all my patients, I'm like, you can say you're clean, you can say you're not clean. It's your recovery. Nobody can take that from you. Nobody can dictate to you what your recovery is. So if you've been living a drug-free, you know, a narcotic-free life, and you're not getting in trouble anymore, you're clean. That's all there is to it.
It sounds like there's a lot of support these days for people in recovery. But is there enough support for families?
No. But the field as a whole is moving in the correct direction. There's an epidemic right now, and people are finally starting to notice it. But as far as families go, like back in the day, I think like if my parents were provided with more information on addiction, on opioid addiction, maybe it would have went a different way. I'm not really sure, but that was almost 15 years ago when I was in the height of my using. And the way the climate is today, there's way more help. You know, there's all kinds of services for family members and, you know, brothers and sisters to understand, like, why is my child or why is my brother, like, dealing with this? And they won't be stigmatized because it is a disease.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about addiction. Ben Grippo has been in recovery. How long now?
I just had 10 years, July 13th. And, you know, you can be like, oh, I got 20 years, I got 30 years. And I think, like, I would always tell people, you know, I would always make a social media post with, like, a number, like, 8, 9, 10. And I got to, like, 10, and I was like, all right, I'm done. Like, I'm done, like, telling people about it because I need to concentrate that energy on getting people what I have, the same amount of clean time. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying I'm recovered, because if you're an addict and you're in recovery, you've never really... the game's not done. It's a daily struggle, you know what I mean? But I love putting my energy to helping people go through, get out of the same, like, storm that I was caught in.
If Ben's story sounds pretty familiar to you, if you've dealt with addiction or someone in your family has, we invite you to call in today, 860-275-7266. Ben's going to stay with us as we move on with the show. And next, we're going to talk about efforts to confront the opioid crisis in Connecticut and nationwide. Again, that number, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Connecticut has an opioid response team that was created last summer by the governor to work on a strategy to reduce opioid-related deaths. Now, since 2013, Connecticut's rate of deaths from drug overdoses has been higher than the national average. 917 people died from drug overdoses in 2016. That's a 25% jump from the previous year, according to the state's chief state medical examiner. Dr. James Gill has said the number of deaths involving the powerful synthetic fentanyl have increased by 155%. Now, in just a few minutes, we're going to hear more about the team the state has put together to try to reduce the number of these deaths. But first on the phone with us, I want to welcome George Temple. He's the first selectman of Oxford, Connecticut. Selectman Temple, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about the town of Oxford. Just recently, it's been reported that your town per capita has seen one of the highest overdose deaths rates in the state.
Yes, we're trying to come to grips with the reason why Oxford would have that awful distinction. Last year we had. 7 overdoses. I went to a lot of those funerals, and it's an awful thing to see. You know, they had the montage of the pictures of the deceased, and you know they were, you know, they looked like any other kid, you know, with the pictures of baseball games and going fishing with their dad and. On various trips to Disneyland or whatever, and then all of a sudden you're looking at a casket, and you know the whole thing is just a horrible situation and something that I don't know whether we can what kind of effect we can have, but I know if we do nothing we'll have no effect, so we're working on it.
Tell us about how you're planning on trying to combat this problem.
Well, we've put together, last year we had a forum on it, and that was pretty well attended, it just didn't seem to be getting any better. So what we're going to be doing, I put together a committee, and, I don't even want to call it a committee. It's just a group of people to talk about opiate addiction and what approach the town should take on it, and what kind of support can we give the families. The people that I really feel for, well, first of all, and you know, if you're addicted to something, it has to be an awful life to live. But what you're putting your family through is just, and I know a lot of these families, and they're really good families and good people, and you know, it happens all over. Mm-hmm. So we're taking the approach that, you know, how do we help them? How do we reach out to them? What do we do to dissuade children or kids or even adults from, you know, taking the first step in the first place? And I don't have the answers. What I'm heartened by is that since we put together this little group, every day I have someone else calling, asking to be a part of it. From people who are addicted themselves or the families of the people that are addicted, or in some cases doctors, just all walks of life. And this is something that that we're all concerned about, and we're in this together. It's kind of amazing. I always say that if we had one death in Oxford from West Nile disease, we would have CNN would be parking on everybody's lawn, and the CDC would be up here in white suits. But you know, we had 7 deaths from opiate addiction, and hardly a ripple. Mm. These people are not bad people that are dying. They're people that made some wrong choices, but that should not be a death sentence. And this whole thing has a devilish grip on people who are addicted to it once they take it.
George Temple is first selectman of Oxford, Connecticut. George, if you could just remain on the line, because I wanted to bring in someone who's working on this from the state level, Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health. He's a member of this Connecticut opioid response team put forth by the governor last summer. Dr. Heimer, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about this response team. Again, who are the members, and what have you been working on the past year?
The team was convened by the governor in his office last spring, or spring of 2016, to come up with a plan to implement evidence-based practices that might, in the short term, decrease the number of opioid overdose deaths. We have a 3-year period in which we're trying to demonstrate that applying 5 or 6 strategies that we know should reduce the number of overdose deaths, if they're properly implemented, can have an impact on reducing the deaths in Connecticut. The members of the team include people from the emergency department, Department of Medicine, School of Public Health, like myself, we put together a plan that was released last fall after consulting with people from around the state, who agreed that these 5 topic areas that we focused on have the greatest possibility of having an effect over the next 3-year period.
Dr. Heimer, could you give us some specifics? And
yes.
With strategy comes the question of resources. So what then?
I will give you each of the 5 areas. The first area is to expand evidence-based treatment for opioid use disorder. And that's specifically methadone and buprenorphine, opiate agonist drugs that we know can be effective in preventing the use of illegal or illicit drugs, that can restore people's ability to work, to engage with successfully with family and community, reduce crime, to reduce the risks of overdose in the short run, and supply, be sure there's an adequate supply of naloxone, the the drug that can be used to reverse opioid overdose and make sure that that's widely distributed in the community. We want to better train doctors and other people who can prescribe opioids to do it in a way that's commensurate with a proper prescribing guidelines, reducing the quantities of opioids prescribed, eliminating prescribing for conditions where opioid prescription is not appropriate, like chronic back pain. We want to increase access to alternatives to using opioids where they're not appropriate. We want to reduce co-prescribing of opioids and benzodiazepines, which augment the likelihood of opioid overdose deaths. And that will require, a lot of this will require physician training. We want to increase the number of physicians who prescribe buprenorphine, which will allow office-based prescribing rather than having to go to a methadone clinic. We think methadone is as, or maybe even a little more effective than buprenorphine, but buprenorphine also is a very effective drug for treating opioid use disorder. But I think some of the most important things in listening to the mayor's conversation, comments, is we really need to increase, and this is one of our plan, part of our plan is to increase community understanding of opioid use as a disease and reduce the stigma associated with seeking treatment.
You're talking about First Selectman of Oxford, George Temple. I wanted to bring him back into the conversation. Selectman Temple, how much do you know about this state response to try to reduce the number of opioid-related deaths? And what would the town of Oxford need from the state to help you as you try to figure out what to do locally?
Well, I think we have a different focus. And this problem is like an onion. It has several layers to it. The treatment is extremely important, Narcan obviously has already saved lives, it has here, but it's getting to the doctor's point. I want to have a little bit more of a greater understanding and empathy for the problem, and remove that stigma. In any way that the state can help with that, it would be terrific. I must say, I'm a lawyer. I'm a criminal lawyer, and I've been practicing for over 40 years. And I kind of fell into a lot of stereotypes myself until I started really looking into this thing. You think of the addict as a weak person, a dependent and all the things that aren't necessarily positive at all. When you look into what the problem is today, this is a death sentence. The doctor's work is doing is try to save lives, and sooner or later it's going to get you. But in the meantime, it wrecks your family and makes you into a thief and a liar, and that's kind of a common thread among opiate addicts over the years that I have seen, is they can't believe them. So, these kind of it's obviously a negative image that, people have. And partially justified, because there are a lot of people in prison who stole for drugs, and that's why they're there. But it goes beyond that. And the problem goes beyond that. It's just, why are these kids starting in the first place, or adults starting in the first place?
Well, Selectman Temple, I want to bring into the conversation a caller. But again, this is where we live today. We're talking about the issue of addiction in our communities. The number of opioid-related deaths continue to grow nationwide. Scott's calling from Danbury. Scott, you're on the show.
Hi. Good morning. So,
I'm sorry, Scott. It sounds you're hard to hear. Are you on speaker by chance?
Yeah, hang on for a second. Is this better?
A little better, thank you.
Okay, so I had a neck injury many years ago, chronic pain. Now I'm disabled at 56. But for 15 years, I was successfully treated with pain management, initially with a low dose, you know, like Vicodin, ultimately going up to about 30 milligram oxycodone. Almost pushing 300 milligrams a day. And at that point, the pain management doctors are complicit because, and the doctor told me they were told by pharma to just keep prescribing. And then, you know, when people started dropping dead, they said, oh, we got to, you know, slow you down. So I tried to get them to slow me down, and they had no plan. They said, go to Silver Hills, New Canaan for 20 grand a day, which I couldn't afford. So I had to go to a methadone clinic, and it worked for me. And now I'm drug-free, but I am in chronic pain all the time, and, you know, I can't work, and it's been very difficult. But the point I wanted to make is that, you know, the doctors need addiction training. That is so critical because the pain management doctors specifically, because they've been complicit in this along with the pharmas, and, you know, that's it's definitely, I don't know if it's starting there, but gosh, it's certainly ending there. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Important points to make. I wanted to go back to Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health. Dr. Heimer, if we could answer some of Scott's questions, including, are we seeing a change in the healthcare profession? Are doctors prescribing fewer opioid prescriptions?
In Connecticut, it seems as though in some parts of the state, yes, and in other parts of the state, no. So more training of physicians is absolutely necessary. The problem has been one in 30 years in the making is that once we recognized that treating pain was important, we had one set of drugs for treating pain. Those were the opioids. It's one of those situations where if you've got a hammer, everything is a nail. It took us a long time to realize that you don't treat chronic pain with opioids, especially chronic neuromuscular kinds of pain like the caller described, Scott described, because you're only masking the underlying symptoms. You're not dealing with them directly. The problem is finding the right treatments for his kind of chronic pain. You know, a lot of that requires changes in our whole healthcare system. If what you require to treat your chronic pain is 6 months of rest and you're holding down a job and you don't have the coverage that would allow you to go on leave and still be paid for 6 months, you can't take that approach. So the system doesn't work for people like this. If you're being told that you need physical therapy and every physical therapy visit requires a copay, again, that's not an economically feasible response for a lot of working class people, even if they have insurance, and certainly isn't a response for people who don't have good health care coverage. So there are some of these fundamental changes that are going to take some long-term pushes, you know, political changes by people like the first selectmen and other people who have to push for changes within the political system to improve the kinds of care that people can get for chronic pain.
Now, we heard from a listener, he couldn't stay on the line, Bruce, but he wanted to know what happens if you do need surgery and you are prescribed painkillers. Is opioid-sparing surgery, is that becoming more of an option for people? We spoke to a doctor at St. Mary's Hospital in Waterbury several months ago where they're trying this more often.
In the short run, opioids are a really good drug for post-surgical pain, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 days. There are very few people who become addicted based on such short-term exposure to opioids, and certainly they help you deal with the initial pain post-surgically or post-traumatic injury. But they're not appropriate drugs for dealing with long-term pain. So we do need alternative mechanisms. I know that, for instance, at Yale New Haven Hospital, the surgical staff has changed the prescribing practices so that when people are released from the hospital, and, you know, we're keeping people in the hospital for shorter and shorter periods after surgery, and we're sending them home when they're still in pain, and we're sending them home with opioids. We want to decrease the amount of opioids we send them home with and you know, medical staff, like the surgical staff at Yale New Haven, have begun to implement these appropriate changes in prescribing tactics, which in the long run will reduce the number of people who develop opioid use problems.
This is Where We Live. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. I wanted to take another call. Jennifer is calling from Hartford. Jennifer, you're on the show.
Hi. I have a question. With the increasing amounts of deaths and incarcerations in Connecticut, what services are being provided for these orphans of addiction? Often these children are placed with family members. Are there any services for the family members? What's in place for these children? Because it's increasing.
That's a good question, Jennifer. And I know Dr. Heimer's focus with the Connecticut Opioid Response Team is looking at trying to reduce opioid-related deaths. But with the membership that's on this committee, Dr. Heimer, I'm sure these kinds of questions come up. We hear from our listeners all the time about trying to find resources for families. And Jennifer wants to know, what about children of addicts?
I really don't know much about that I can be of direct help with. I know that as we try to get more of the state agencies to talk to each other, it becomes clear that bringing in people from the state children and youth services will be critically important for addressing questions such as this. But in the short run, especially with the state budget issues in Connecticut and the lack of resources, it's going to be hard to figure out how to find the money we need to deal with all of these related issues. And, of course, these are very large social issues, not just individual issues of disease and proper disease treatment, but of the social factors that underlie and create the desire on the part of so many people to experiment with and subsequently become addicted to opioids.
Bruce is calling from Hartford. Bruce, we have a couple of minutes, if you could be quick.
Hi. So I'm a 53-year-old guy who is 27 years clean off of drugs and alcohol, and I was able to get this far by going to 12-step meetings. And I just wanted to comment, I'm really surprised to not hear any discussion at the state planning level about utilizing the resource that we have in almost every community of Narcotics Anonymous and other 12-step fellowship programs.
Thank you, Bruce, for your call. I wanted to go back to our in-studio guest, Ben Grippo. He's a West Hartford resident. He's been clean for 10 years now, counselor at Hartford Dispensary in Bristol. We had touched on this a little bit earlier, but everyone's journey is different. A lot of people have questions about what works best for them. Where do people go for these answers?
To answer that caller's questions about, 12-step programs, NAAA, there's even Methadone Anonymous meetings. Follow to a T. The 12-step program is pretty perfect, but that's people are people and they take their own take on it. I myself, straight out of rehab, probably went to an NA meeting once a day for a few months. And then, life started to take over and I would, dial it back a little bit. But I'll tell you, some of the things I heard people say in those meetings stayed with me. And that's what I tell my patients. I don't push 12-step meetings on them because it's not for everybody. But the ones that do like it, I tell them, go there, listen, and take something home. Because somebody there has gone through the same thing you have, and then you can make a connection. And I think that's the biggest gift that NA or AA could do for anybody in that situation.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, Ben Grippo in studio with me. I want to thank Dr. Robert Heimer, professor of epidemiology and pharmacology at Yale School of Public Health, a member of the Connecticut Opioid Response Team. Dr. Heimer, thank you for your time today.
Well, you're welcome. Can I have one comment on the 12-step issue?
Very quickly.
We know from 100 years of work that abstinence is not the appropriate treatment for opioid use disorder. It works for a very small percentage of people. Opioid agonist therapy works for about 8 times as many people successfully. So we want to prioritize proper treatment, not give people a treatment that allows them to relapse and then overdose subsequently.
Dr. Heimer, thank you for that point. We appreciate it. Also, to Selectman George Temple, who's the first Selectman of Oxford, Connecticut, thank you for your time today, sir.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we consider how the discussions around drug abuse have changed dramatically in recent decades. The victims of the current opioid crisis look very different from the drug crises of the past, where punishment, not recovery, was emphasized. What have been the lasting consequences on the Black community in the U.S.? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. When drug abuse impacts families from all backgrounds, stigma can begin to be erased. But what are the long-lasting consequences of the government's war on drugs in the 1980s and the impact on people of color? Joining us now is Echo Yonka, professor of law at Yeshiva University's Cardozo Law School in New York City. Echo, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You've written and been featured in interviews recently about when we look at this drug epidemic sweeping our country. You often will reflect on what happened 30 years ago when our country saw another epidemic, as you write, of, quote, addiction, death, and crime. Remind us of that time in our history, and what lessons can we learn?
Well, I think anybody, anybody of even early middle age here remembers very much what life looked like when we were terrified and made terrified of the crack epidemic. That is, it was in fact terrifying. But we also remember that we were told of super predators stalking the streets. We were constantly bombarded with images of crack mothers and crack babies. That is to say, there was a social sort of decision, diffuse, but certainly led by our government, to paint this as a crime of pathology, of failures of character, something wrong with those people. And those people, it was very clear who they were, right? It was inner city African Americans. And we were told that they were going to be responsible and that we were going to punish our way out of it. We declared a war on drugs. It has been stunning to see, though I'm thrilled, of course, that we're not returning to those same mistakes. It's a remarkable contrast when you think that the president just last week declared a national public health emergency in the case of the opioids epidemic. So our cultural memory is one of remarkably different contrasts on this same issue.
Now, you also write that your points are not about racial guilt, but you want to stress about lessons learned. Disparities still exist today, Echo. What still needs work?
Yeah, I mean, so what I mean by I'm not interested in racial guilt is, I should be clear, I'm not interested in guilt for its own sake. I think guilt is an emotionally healthy response when we say we did something wrong and we will strive to do better, rather than the sort of cheap guilt of finger pointing. So, look, I mean, what we know is, if we search for the humanity of those who are suffering with social problems, when we see a problem, it's a social problem, we can make a decision about how to treat it. And we need to learn, we need to think and reflect deeply about why we are so quick to treat problems in Black and Hispanic communities as police problems. And when we see the exact same problem in white communities, we say, this is a social problem we need to fix. And if we can fix that feeling, then hopefully the tomorrows are better, because the next time we see a problem, we don't relapse into the same easy racism.
I want to go back to our in-studio guest, Ben Grippo. He's a counselor at Hartford Dispensary and Methadone Clinic in Bristol, Connecticut. Ben, when you talk to your clients, do you feel that they are getting the access to the appropriate treatment, no matter their race?
Today, yes. 30 years ago, no. Definitely not. I feel like the African American community back in the crack epidemic was villainized, and that's all you saw in pictures and on the news, and nobody was really showing the other side of it, because there was definitely a lot of Caucasian crack users back in the day, and I don't think it really became they didn't really start looking at it differently until this opioid addiction started killing white high school kids, and then it was an issue. That's when everybody opened their eyes, and that's really sad, because it was painted to be an African-American problem from the 60s, people coming back from Vietnam in the 80s, and even now, but it's not. It's everybody, and I'll give you a statistic. My clinic that I work at is predominantly Caucasian, maybe because of the geographic location, but it's really not like an African-American thing. It's about anybody. And I don't think they started taking initiative on it until, you know, your local Caucasian soccer mom OD'd, you know what I mean? Or young white kids in high school.
I want to take a quick call from a listener. Joe's calling from Bristol. Joe, are you there? Oh, let me try it. Nope, Joe is not there. I'll go back to Echo. So when we talked about disparities that still exist today, in Connecticut especially, when people are in jail for whatever reason, there is this emphasis for helping people restart their lives, a second chance, so to speak. Is that happening for people that have drug records as well, Echo?
No, of course not. So, you know, now, of course, frankly, it makes me sad to say I think we will see a change when we get a slew of people who are released from jail because of their drug record. But look, I mean, the case is exactly as you point out. It's just when we saw people either gripped by addiction or imprisoned for addiction and they were black, we looked for what was wrong with them, right? So let me take high-profile examples, even if they're an atypical, right? Everybody just thought, what is wrong with Whitney Houston? I mean, here is a woman who has the world in her hand, and then she fell in with this rough guy, Bobby Brown, right? He was painted lightly as a thug. He was the bad influence. And now, look, you know, there was a sort of, what is wrong with her? Philip Seymour Hoffman, one of the great actors of our generation, dies in his Manhattan apartment, and the only stories were about the heartbreak of drug addiction. Now, I'm not saying people weren't sympathetic to Whitney Houston. My only point is, it is just remarkable how different our responses are depending on how much we care about the people we're viewing and how much our care depends on race. And that includes what happens with their ability to reincorporate and reenter society, including rehabilitation and their criminal record and the collateral sanctions that follow them.
Oh, we just have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to get back to our in-studio guest, Ben Grippo. We heard Echo mention the president declaring this opioid epidemic a national emergency. But saying it is one thing. What's it going to take to actually impact these local communities across the country?
It's been a problem for years, and just because our current president said it the other day doesn't change anything. Until they start throwing FEMA money on it, I'm not buying anything. You know what I mean? It all comes down to a community level, because you'll come to these states and you'll see different states and different cities putting different emphasis on the problem. But as a nation, it all needs to be the same across the board. I don't care if you live in Nevada, Rhode Island. Everybody's using opiates everywhere. Everybody's dying. So to put a little bit more emphasis on this white community and less over here, it needs to be straight across the board. And like we were talking before, him saying he changed his view over the couple of days and saying that
the president,
if they don't start, they don't have a problem. And I think he got a lot in his ear after that, because he went back and he changed his speech on that. But yeah, it's hard. It's very hard.
Well, I want to thank Ben Grippo for coming into the studio today. Again, a West Hartford resident. We appreciate you sharing your story with us, Ben.
Thank you so much.
And also to Echo Yonka, professor of law at Yeshiva University's Cardoza Law School in New York City. We'll tweet out some of the articles you've written. Echo, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you for joining. Thank you for having me.
Now, today's show was produced by Jeff Tyson. We wanted to wish Jeff good luck as he heads back to New York State to be closer to family. I was thinking back to the shows we worked on together, and two stick out in my mind. One on the history of boxing in Connecticut, and another on barbershops. Interestingly enough, the on-air sparring happened during the barbershop show. If you didn't hear that one, we want you to check it out at WMPR.org/where we live. Thanks, Jeff. I also want to thank Lydia Brown, Kion Wolf, Katie Talarski. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.